Please stand by. Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's IBM Tivoli Talk conference. The topic for today's conference is Hyper-Dispatch Management with Omega One XC on ZOS. Today's call is being recorded. During today's conference, all lines will be open. We would like to encourage you to utilize your mute function, if at all possible, to minimize background noise. We also ask that you not place your line on hold with music. Doing so will place music into the entire conference. And at this time, I would like to turn the call over to Mr. Fabio Tozzi. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. Good day, everybody, and welcome to our first session of 2009 of our... our tech talks from the ZIA development team. And the topic of the day is, you know, understanding hyper-dispatching with Omega One XC on ZOS. And the speaker of the day is Lawrence Hart, one of our key technical guys in the development team. So we're already a little behind, so I'll just turn it over to Lawrence to walk you guys through the deck. Lawrence, it's all yours.
Thanks, Fabio. Well, good morning. Good afternoon, everybody. We're here to try and understand a little bit of what hyper-dispatch is by use of examples of Omega One XC on ZOS and Omega One 3270 screen spaces and workspaces. And a lot of the presentation does introduce the technology. I don't know how familiar the audience is. It's probably varying from no knowledge to, to very good knowledge. So I'll try and catch up on time. We're already behind. I apologize for that. I had a screen sharing problem. We'll move to the slide two, trademarks. No need to check those out. And the agenda basically is a brief introduction. What is hyper-dispatch? Some background, which is important, about the Z10 architecture, processor caches to which hyper-dispatch is very strongly related. The Z10 complex architecture itself, the book architecture. Then some hyper-dispatch basics. We'll get into each one of these topics here. And the third main bullet there, let Omega One show you why you should switch hyper-dispatch on. That's interspersed throughout the hyper-dispatch basics. As I introduce the topic on hyper-dispatch, I'll use an Omega One XC or 3270 screen space workspace to illustrate points. So let's move to slide four. What is hyper-dispatch? Well, hyper-dispatch is a new workload dispatching mechanism, if we didn't already know that. It's available. You need a hardware and operating system level combination of the IBM System Z10 and ZOS 110. The support is retrofitted to ZOS 19 and 18 with maintenance. The idea of hyper-dispatch is to actually improve overall performance, service delivery from the Z10 through optimizing processor level caching, and we'll be getting into the caching and the different levels of cache in a moment. But the main thing that really happens here with the Z10 and hyper-dispatch is that there is synergy between the LPAR hypervisor controlling the physical processing complex and ZOS to actually allow mapping of logical processes in LPAR mode, which is the way you have to run on a Z10 these days, mapping the logical processor resource to the physical processor resources controlled by Prism or the LPAR hypervisor. Now, the rationale sort of, just historically, the last three generations of processors, Z990, Z9, Z10, the cycle time of the cores, the processing chips, has decreased. The cycle time, or if you like, the frequency of execution on each of the chips has increased dramatically to where it is today at 4.4 gigahertz. Unfortunately, or at the same time, the cost of accessing main memory has stayed about the same. So what this means is that the importance of processor-level caching instructions and data at the chip level and not going to main memory to obtain this information has become more and more important because the cost of going to main memory has grown proportionately greater, and we can expect it to continue to do so in the future. Just note that laws of physics are pushing system architects to use increasing numbers of processors versus faster processors. And Moore's law, which says every 18 months, you know, the capacity of a system is going to double, it's sort of running out of gas. we can't increase the speed of light at which, you know, connections, the speed at which connection between components on the chip actually communicate, or shrink an atom. We're down to, I think, 65 nanometer technology now. We're getting down to the level of, you know, a few layers of atoms. So that's why we're moving to more processors versus faster processors. But Amdahl's law, which basically says there are diminishing returns as you increase the number of processors when you apply that to a workload. So there are two things that are working against us here to deliver more and more efficiency or resource in the processing complex. And we'll see how hyperdispatch goes some way towards making the future and faster, or delivering more and more service to workloads. How hyperdispatch is going to help that. Note here that ZOS is shipped with hyperdispatch inactive. So out of the box, ZOS does not switch hyperdispatch on. But when you get your new Z10, LSPR benchmarks are actually performed with hyperdispatch activated. That's very important to know. Moving on to the next slide. Okay, just I'll briefly go through these slides. The Z10 architecture. What we're looking here on the right schematically is a processor core, 4.4 gigahertz, as I mentioned earlier. And the first level of processor caching is level 1. It's a split cache, 128 kilobytes of for data, 64 kilobytes for instructions. Each one of these caches contains 256-byte rows that are brought in and discarded from cache. And this is where processing is going to be fastest. If you have instructions in cache, then they're going to be executed in basically one cycle. Anything stored into the level 1 cache is also stored into what's known on a Z10 as a level 1.5 cache, which is 3 megabytes in size. Again, this is a store-through cache. Excuse me? Sorry, I heard... was that a question or just interference? Okay. Moving on to the next slide. Again, now we just looked at the schematic of the Z10 core. On the Z10, each of the processor unit chips is a quad core. There are four processor cores, and we see a schematic here on the right with a little picture on the left there of the actual Z10 processing unit. But anyway, what we need to note here is that we see the caches on each of the processor cores, four, and processor cores themselves, each the pair, of course, shares a cryptographic and compression coprocessor, and there are controllers that actually connect to off-chip level 2 cache, which we'll see in a moment. And also, depending on the chip, you'll have both memory and connections to both main memory and the I.O. busing, but only four out of the five chips on a memory module actually do that in each case. But we'll see that also. Okay, moving on to the next slide, slide 7. There are five IBM Z10 models. We see the E12 through the E64, and the thing to note here is that these models have from 1 to 4 books. Each book mounts a multi-chip module, an MCM, and each one of these MCMs has five of the quad-core processing unit chips and two storage controller unit chips. I won't go through all of these, but depending on the model, how many books you have, which Z10 model, there are a variety of numbers of processing units that you'll find on each of the four books. All of the processor units can be characterized as a standard CPU or a general processor, DAP, ZIP, an ICF or an IFL, that is a specialty engine. The processor level cache, level 2 cache, is 48 megabytes. There are two storage control unit chips underneath that, so there are 24 megabytes per storage controller. And that is a store-in cache, so whatever stored into level 1, level 1.5 cache will always be found in the level 2 cache. The level 2 caches are connected in a point-to-point or star configuration on the Z10. So if you have four books on the Z10, you're never more than one remote level 2 cache away from finding data or instructions. On the Z9, the prior model, On a four book model, you could be two level two caches away from finding storage, and that is a processor hit. So there's a big storage improvements in the way the level two caches are connected on the Z10. Okay, moving to the next slide, slide eight. Here we see a Z10 architecture, basically putting together everything that we've just looked at before. We see the four books, we see the processor unit chips with four cores, the level one 1.5 caches connected to the storage controller mounted level two cache. We see the connections to the memory, which can be up to 384 gigabytes per book for or 1.5 terabytes on a four book system. And you can peruse this at your leisure later on. I don't have time to really go through a lot of this now. But to give you some background on just where the caches are on the Z10, and we'll see just what importance they play in the hyper-dispatch technology. So next slide, slide nine. So why hyper-dispatch? Well, fetching instructions and data for Z10 processor execution is varying levels of cost, and we've just mentioned all the different levels of cache. Level one cache, we get a one-cycle cost of for fetching. Level 1.5, we're going to get a four-cycle cost, which, you know, is not too bad, four cycles. But once we get off-chip to level two processor cache, the local cache is going to be 100 or so cycles. Going, as I said, to one of the star-connected remote level 2 caches will cost 200 cycles. So that's relatively very expensive compared to finding an instruction or data in level 1 or level 1.5 caches. But when we start going out to main memory, because we cannot get a hit on what we on a fetch in one of the processor caches, we're looking at 600 cycles as the cost for a fetch. So that becomes very expensive. So obviously we need to minimize main memory fetches, and where we can, try and maintain data and instructions in the at the chip level, in the 1 to 1.5 level caches. But because of the nature of commercial workload, it's really the level 2 cache, this 48 megabyte cache in each book, that is where our hyper-dispatch is mostly focused. There's a bullet here that the increasing processor speed, as I mentioned earlier, and the numbers of books, because that's because of these remote level 2 caches that get involved, the increasing processor speed exacerbates the cost of cache misses in an SMP environment, which is what the Z10 is, an SMP fabric, and that means all processors have access to all of memory. So to make that happen, all of the processor caches and books are connected, and we are running in an SMP, like I say, fabric. Okay, now PRISM. If we repeatedly dispatch logical processes on the same physical, processor units, or processor units in the same book, so on the same MCM, so in other words, we're dispatching logical processes, so they take advantage of, at worst, the level 2 cache for caching purposes, the chances are improved of finding instructions and data in one of the caches on that MCM and not having to go to main memory. Also, we can somewhat minimize the relatively expensive cross-book level 2 cache searches. So to find data instructions in level 2 caches remotely, it's twice the cost of going to our local level 2 cache. For COS, if it also repeatedly dispatches work units, SRBs, TCBs, at the lowest level of address space or enclave, to the same logical processor or group of logical processors that are mapped to processor units on the same processor chip or book. So what we're looking at here is mapping logical processors to physical processors. I mentioned that up front. So if we can make that happen, we can improve performance because we can affect intelligent dispatching of work units to optimize hardware processor cache efficiency. It's all about processor caching. But to make this happen, PRISM and ZOS, they have to collaborate, and ZOS has to be made aware of the physical processor placements so that it can map it, the logical processors it's dispatching to that physical resource. Okay, so moving to the next slide, slide 10. here we've got a schematic, and it looks pretty complicated, I know, but it's good for reference. If we just focus on the lower left-hand corner, what we have here are two ZOS LPARs, LPAR-1, LPAR-2. If we look at LPAR-1, it has six logical processes, and we see that the four of the processes, LP0 through LP3, are contained in what is known as a high polarity affinity pool, affinity pool 1. And there can be one or more affinity pools in ZOS, and we'll see how we calculate how many pools there are and how many processes are in the high polarity affinity pools in a moment. Each affinity pool has an affinity queue, and this queue is where ZOS dispatches the SRBs and TCBs that are going to run in the logical processes. Now, there is a concept of high polarity and medium polarity affinity pools. The high polarity affinity pools, just so you know, they effectively become dedicated or pseudo-dedicated processes. If you're familiar with the concept of a dedicated LPAR, where processes, a physical process is dedicated to an LPAR, well, this goes some way towards dedicating a set or subset of logical processes to a physical processor. And the number of high polarity processes is calculated based on an LPAR's weight as a fraction of the total weight of all shared LPARs in the complex. Now, the medium polarity pool, there is the concept of a fraction of resource that doesn't quite allow a whole physical processor to be part of the physical processor to be part of the logical processor resource. But that fraction can be used for logical processes that are not high. That's the concept of what's known as medium and low logical processes. And ZOS will dispatch work to the medium polarity affinity pool, and that affinity pool will also map to physical resource, but it's more of a shared physical resource. And that's the key difference, is that the high polarity affinity processes are mapped to high polarity physical processes. So just looking at LPAR-1, we now move up and we look at the prism, the top box there in green, and we look at, on the left there, we see the prism logical processor ready dispatch queue. We see some of the processes from ZOS LPAR 2 and one from ZOS LPAR 1. PRISM is going to dispatch logical processes that are designated high affinity into a high affinity node. Notice there are four physical processes in high affinity node 1. They can be anywhere from 1 to 4. There's no limit. 4 is the current limit on a Z10. There might only be one or two or three physical processes in an affinity node that map to the processes that ZOS knows about, the logical processes in the affinity pool. So what we see here is that the high polarity affinity pool 1 process, logical processes from ZOS LPAR 1 are actually running on high affinity node 1 physical processes, LP0 through 3. Now, if the LPAR is consuming the maximum resource or its fair share of resource, these high affinity processes will be dedicated to the ZOS LPAR 1. And similarly, we see high affinity node 2 under prism control is actually mapping the high polarity affinity pool 1 processes for ZOS LPAR 2. And as the number of LPARs grows, you would see this. You could extrapolate this. I'll take it out to the point where for each LPAR, you would have, you know, one or more affinity pools. You may not always get a high affinity pool, and we'll see that later on. But anyway, so this schematic basically illustrates the connection between ZOS and PRISM as far as logical processes, the dispatching pools, and the physical processes, and the PRISM dispatching of those logical processes. What we see connecting the two levels here between PRISM and ZOS, just for your reference, there is a new instruction, which is a little low level, but how does ZOS know what the physical mapping of, or what is the mapping of the physical processes? It issues an STSI instruction that literally returns a structure that contains the physical topology and tells it where it can dispatch its logical processes at the various levels, high or medium, or one we don't see here is a low affinity processor. And over to the right, we see this PTF instruction. That, in fact, is not a program temporary fix. It's a form topology function, and it can actually switch hyper-dispatch on and off internally. But more importantly, if the number of processes changes within the physical complex, each of the L pods will adjust its medium and or its high and medium pools to reflect a change in weight relative to the physical complex. And we'll see that as we go along. Moving to the next slide, slide 11. I've been talking about logical processes share, and there are three levels of sharing. There are high share logical processes, medium, and low share logical processes. Okay, starting with high. High logical share logical processes are assigned based on the number of shared physical processes in the complex. And when I say shared, when you're calculating the high share logical processes, you have to subtract out any dedicated LPARS processes, physical processes. Those work today as they always have. Under hyper-dispatch, there is a performance benefit, you know, through caching. But essentially, when you're in an LPAR that has shared processes, you're calculating how many high-share processes are going to be assigned to that LPAR. You must take the complex, all of the shared physical processes, and then you basically take the shared LPAR's weight, the assigned weight, and divide that by the total weight of all shared LPARs, and that will give you, and I actually show an example of the calculation later on, it'll give you usually a number, a fractional number, the whole number component of that number will be the number of high processors, and it can be zero, in which case you'll end up with, you know, just with a medium processor, or two medium processors maybe, but anyway, the high share logical processes, as I said, can be considered pseudo-dedicated, or sometimes you hear the term quasi-dedicated. And effectively, it's a one-to-one mapping between a logical and a physical processor. One can consider the share of a high logical processor as 100%, around there. It is pseudo-dedicated, so it's not a hard 100%. Because, as we see in the next bullet, if a high-share processor actually is not, there's no work actually dispatched to a high-share logical processor, other processors in the complex, other LPARs and processors from this complex can use cycles on the physical processor to which a high-share logical processor is dedicated. So there's, as is today, if an LPAR is not using its share of the complex, other LPARs that need to consume more than their share can actually pick up the spare cycles. So that concept of prism management and physical resource management is still holds today. There's a note here, dedicated LPAR logical processors are all given high share. You can switch on hyper-dispatch in dedicated mode because of the affinity pool concept of hyper-dispatch. Even in dedicated mode, you can find performance improvements because the cache is used more efficiently, even though you're dedicating physical resource to an LPAR. Okay, medium share logical processors. As I say, assigned from the fractional component of a high share logical processor calculation. This is the fractional component of the calculation I was talking about earlier. Medium logical processors share physical processors, and their share can be considered as being between 1 and 100%. One or two medium logical processors per LPAR. In a dedicated LPAR, it so happens that all of them are high, and so there are zero mediums. And we'll see on the next slide, I think, when we get one, you know, what determines whether we get one or two medium logical processors. And here's a concept which I do get into a little later on. A medium share processor is actually an anchor for the remaining percentage, the non-high percentage that's allocated, that is guaranteed to an LPAR, and it's shared between the medium share logical processor, or the two that might be there, and any unpark low share logical processes. Now, we'll get into parking and unparking and low share, but essentially, processes can be added to the affinity pools on ZOS, and the medium share, guaranteed share of a physical processor, is shared equally across all processes that are either medium or unparked low. Low share logical processors. These are the remaining logical processors after high and medium processors are signed. So you you basically define, you know, you configure your LPAR with it's a good thing to configure your LPAR with as many logical processors as there are physical processors in the complex, because hyperdispatch will simply put all processors that are not high or medium into a long wait unless there are spare cycles that can be utilized by the LPAR. Low logical processor share is, you know, considered at 0%. The resource is considered discretionary. So if a low share processor, like I said, only uses cycles from the complex when an LPAR's demand is greater than its configured share and there are cycles available from the complex. And we see some numbers here where these processors are unparked. Typically when the complex utilization overall, the physical utilization, is 98% or less. Don't hold me on that number. Can be varied by IBM with engineering changes. Right now it's around 98. And the average unparked low share utilization, that is the utilization of the medium and any unparked low processors, if that average is getting towards 94%, then unparking of processors, if spare resources available, will start occurring. Moving to the next slide, we see another Omegamon screenshot. And I should explain that there are two screenshots here. One, the lower left is the LPAR command output in Omegamon 3270. And this actually is an existing command. But the large screen there is a new screen space developed in 4.10, Omegamon XE on ZOS version 4.10. And what we're looking at here basically is really an explanation of when do we get just one medium share processor, when do we get two. Because this is something, if you're with a customer, or you're trying to explain how to dispatch to somebody, this is a question that will inevitably come up. And really, when we calculate the physical processor, the high and medium share processor mix, the third bullet here has the actual calculation. And I've plugged in the numbers from number one, the high medium processor allocation in the third bullet is equal to the LPAR weight. In this case, if you look at the LPAR command output, we can see that in this case it happens to be JC0, the LPAR, the second LPAR in the list of LPARs here, has a weight of 100. We multiply that by the number of physical processors, and we see that the number of CPs is 21, in the LPAR command. And then divide that by the total LPAR weight. That's the shared these are all shared LPARs here. And we divide by the weight of 475. And that ends up being calculated to 4.42. So what that works out as being is three high and 1.42 medium share processors, because the fractional component of the calculation result is 0.42. It's less than 50%. It's less than 0.5. So what happens here is that the 1.42 mediums are actually split into two medium share processors, and each one of those will be given an equal share of 0.711, which is 71.1%, which we see in the larger, the output of the HDSP command in the Omegamon 3270 screen space here. And so that hopefully explains why, you know, and as I said, in a dedicated LPAR, you see zero mediums. Moving to the next, another Omegamon 3270 example. And by the way, Omegamon XE on ZOS, all of the data in Omegamon XE on ZOS is identical, at least the actual data. The presentation obviously is different, but the data is actually sourced from Omegamon 3270 running under the Tivoli Enterprise the TEMS, and you will see these numbers reformatted, and I do have examples of the XE workspaces. So now what happens when only one high or medium share processor is configured? Now this is sort of important, and it relates actually to when HyperDispatch and the Z10 were released early last year. There are a number of problems that inevitably you're going to find that things don't always work as expected. And one thing that happened was is that the original algorithms would, in the case of if we look on the screen space example, HyperDispatch, Omega 132 command is split into standard CPUs, zaps, and zips. And if you look at the zaps and zips, what we see there is that there's a share percent column. And we see that the share is very low, 21.6 in both cases. Now, this is a low weight LPAR, which is commonly found in test LPARs in a lot of installations or installations that run a lot of LPARs. And the original algorithm would only unpark or keep active a medium processor and not unpark any of the low processors configured to the LPAR. This could be problematical if the medium processor went into a spin loop. To manage that loop and actually kill a task, one needs another logical processor actually available to run the management task to do that. Also, if one has a very high priority, workload manager defined a high priority task running, it would dominate any discretionary or lower priority tasks such that workload characteristics would not be as one might expect in a non-hyper-dispatch environment. So here we see that with maintenance, and the APAR is mentioned here, OA24272, you always have two logical processors available, that is a medium and always at least one unparked low processor available to the LPAR. That is ZAP, ZIPs, and standard processors. Okay, and the third example on share here, why are some of my logical processor shares greater than 100%? Well, this is something that could always happen. It's a matter of basically overweighting or overallocation of a share. And what's happened here is that the weight assigned to this LPAR ZAPS, this is a ZAP hyper-dispatch pool, is actually more than the two logical processors that are actually online here can ever consume. So when you see over 100% share, it means that the configuration of the LPAR weight is actually being left, the excess weight is being left on the table for other LPARs, ZAPs to consume. And if really the systems programmer or the whoever is running the system intended that full weight to be consumed by the LPAR ZAPs, then it tells us that at least one more ZAP should be configured online. We see two reserved ZAPs there. We should bring one of those online. In this particular case, it turns out that the ZAPs were running at full tilt. And by the way, seeing ZAP utilization above 85% can be, and I'll mention this later on, it can be somewhat of a problem. In that it's tasks that are switching, to Java code and then running on the ZAP, WebSphere, for example. If the ZAP resources is not available, then unexpected amounts of standard CPU resource will be consumed due to what's called crossover. But anyway, so this is an interesting one. It applies to, you see this with HyperDispatch switched on, but it applies to processes today without HyperDispatch, is that too much share is allocated, more than the LPAR can consume. And this screen just happens to identify that problem. Moving to the next slide. Here we see a very simplistic view of how the low unparked processors share the allocated medium share. We see here in the schematic at the bottom, there's a medium share of 80% in this case. As processors are unparked, one low processor is unparked, the medium share of AC is shared between the two processors, the original medium and the low. They get 40% each. And then another logical processor is unparked. Each one of them gets a guaranteed share of 26.6% and so on to the 20% when you've got three unparked processors. The message being that when Prism sees these logical processors in the dispatch queue, each one of the processors will be considered for dispatch and priority based on a weight that's assigned equally amongst all of them. So it's worth noting that even though there's a medium and it has a weight, a percentage associated with it, that when you see low share processors unparked, that they have a share, an equal share amongst them. And we'll see that on the next slide. And what we're seeing here is, if we look at the top screen there, we see five low share standard CPs unparked. In this particular case, we've got, it's the other example that we saw earlier, where we have 142.2% medium, two mediums unparked, plus the five unparked low processors. The 142.2, if you divide that by 7, each one of these processors, the two medium, five unparked lows, will actually have a guaranteed share of 20.3% of a physical processor. Okay, so that essentially is what we're seeing here. And we're seeing how by using the LPAR command, which we saw earlier, the existing command, that the complex percentage utilization is physical utilization is 85.2%, but the demand, that is the demand percentage, which we see in the XL power output, is 209.1%. It's more, 100% would be demanding as much as guaranteed to the LPAR. Because they're the spare resource and the LPAR is actually dispatching more work than was configured for it, for its share, it's actually running more than twice its configured share, and it's able to get the resource. So we see those five low-share processors in the top example there running at around 90% utilization. So that's just an example of how spare complex cycles can still be allocated to a hyper-dispatch mode LPAR.
Lawrence, this is Fab. Just one quick reminder that you only have 15 minutes left, and you're only 17 slides out of 49.
Oh yeah, sorry, Fab. There's actually the last. It's actually a lot shorter than 49.
Very good.
Yeah, I've got some backup and just straight screenshots, which we're going through as we go along. So I think I can pretty much get it in by 12. So
perfect. Thank you.
So how does Intelligent Resource Director, IRD, play into all of this? Well, it just so happens that there are two CPU management facets of IRD. One is to manage the weight of the LPAR based on workload manager goals not being achieved or being overachieved, and bringing CPUs on and offline based on the same thing. Under hyper-dispatch mode, the CPU, the bringing online, taking offline of logical processors is switched off. So IRD will only manage the weight of the LPAR. But as it manages the weight of the LPAR, and say, for example, that an LPAR, its work, important work, is missing goals, then the IRD may increase the weight of the LPAR in an attempt to help meet those goals. Then as that happens, because the weight of the LPAR has changed, then the calculation of high and medium processor changes. And we see here an example, which you can read for yourselves. I don't have time to go through it. But basically, the proportion of high to medium processors will change based on LPAR weight management through IRD. Similarly, on the C10, we have capacity provisioning management, so through a policy or through manual changes, physical processors can be added to the complex. The same thing, because, the high-medium calculation incorporates the number of physical processors in the complex. So as we add a processor, then the high-medium calculation changes. Hybrid dispatch adjusts to this. We saw earlier a PTF instruction, a perform topology function. ZOS is alerted of these kinds of changes, an addition of a physical processor, so that it will then increase or maybe decrease the number of high share, the portion of high share processors in the LPAR. Okay, moving to the next slide 18. Here's an Omega 1XC workspace. And what we're seeing here is basically the LPAR clusters workspace. The top pane there that's highlighted shows the capacity provisioning management aspects or changes that might occur. And CPM here actually took the model from a Z10 19 way up to a Z10 37 way. And, you know, as that happened, that the hyper-dispatch mode LPARs would have adjusted quite dramatically, obviously, with that much of a change, the number of high and medium share processors. And below that, as far as IRD is concerned, one can monitor the weights, the current weight, LPAR weight. And if we move across there, we see the initial maximum and minimum weights, which are IRD-related. Okay, we see that just to the left of the three weights, the initial maximum minimum, the WLM managed indicator says, yeah, if it says yes, then IRD LPAR weight management will be active. And when, in this case, no weights have been adjusted, but if they had been, you would notice it here. So moving to the next slide, we're looking at an example here of basically, again, I don't want to go into numbers, but we've got a complex with 18 physical processors, two LPARs. One has 12 logical processors with a weight of an LPAR weight of 200, LPAR 2 with 18 logical processors and a weight of 800. Now, I'm illustrating here the next four or five slides, the difference between horizontal dispatching, or the way we do it before hyper-dispatch, and vertical dispatching, which is also known as hyper-dispatch. So if we'll see this example here. With hyper-dispatch equals no, hyper-dispatch is switched off. We see the physical processors, two books. We see Prism there. And below we see the LPAR 1, LPAR 2. And what I'm trying to illustrate is that each logical processor to consume the configured weight, or it's an LPAR to configure its fair share of resource, each logical processor has to be dispatched. That is part of the algorithm in ZOS before hyper-dispatch. So each of these logical processors effectively gets an equal weight, LPAR 1, 30% of physical processor, and LPAR 2, 80%. If we go to the next screen, the next slide 21, what I'm showing here in the top, the Prism dispatching on the physical processors are the logical processor time slices that are actually being dispatched on the physical processors. So we see that, I've made it easy, that each physical processor, one-fifth of the time is given to a processor from LPAR 1, and the remaining four-fifths is given to a processor from LPAR 2. Now, it doesn't necessarily, this is a little simplistic, but this is effectively what Prism tries to do. But the main point here is that these logical processes, not only are they to be most efficient in terms of acquiring the full share, LPAR weight share, that the logical processes have to be dispatched across all physical processes. Based on what we said right at the beginning of the presentation, that means the processor caches are not being effectively utilized. And that's what I'm trying to illustrate through these schematics, is that if we go to the next slide, which is now shows with hybrid dispatch on how the calculations change for the same complex, and you can look at this later, but we can basically see how many high and medium and low share processors we end up with. And we move to the next, same complex. This is slide 23. We see the same Prism, 18 physical processors in two books. But now if we look at ZOS and how its logical processes set up. For LFAR 1, we have three high-share processors with one effectively 100% share, one medium at 60%. And then in LFAR 2, we actually see 13 logical processors that are high in 100% share and two mediums at 70%. So how will they be dispatched across the physical processors in prison? It's a very different picture, and you'd have to study the colors here, but effectively, as I mentioned earlier, that with the schematic early on in the presentation, there are affinity pools down in LPAR 1 and LPAR 2 under COF, and we see that, for example, LP 0, 1, and 2 on the left, top left in LPAR 1 are actually dispatched on affinity node 4, AN4, in the top of the orange box on the right of the prison box there. And so on for each of these groups. We see groups of four physical processors. If we notice on the right in prison, there's an AN, an affinity node 5, that is simply one high share processor. That's because it's a remainder from the allocation of four. It doesn't always happen this way. You might get a 3 and a 2. It depends on the most efficient allocation based on LPAR weights. It can get more complicated, but prison will try and do this with the allocation of the processors. We see mapping of an affinity pool in ZOS to a physical process in an affinity node under prism. And we see that the mediums, if we look at in LPAR 1, in blue, there's LP3, and we go up to prism on the right in affinity node 6, we see that actually the medium share from LPAR 1 and the medium shares from LPAR 2, LP7, LP8 in orange there, they share a processor. There's no, so that's how it works, that it's almost business as usual, almost like a non-hyper dispatch, dispatching mechanism for the non-high share processors. Okay, moving on. Just to illustrate the difference between hyper dispatch dispatching and pre-hyper dispatch, we see a complex, same complex, once with hyper dispatch on and once with it off. With it on, if we draw our attention to CPU 0 through CPU 04, we see that they are active at, 80-87%. At the bottom of the screen space there, we see a PAR 12, which is LPAR 12, the LPAR ID, and a 26% utilization. We move to the upper right. When hyper-dispatch is switched off, we have the same LPAR. It's running at 26%, but look at the CPUs, the logical processors. They are all dispatched from 0 to 16 logical processors, all dispatched. The same happens with the specialty processors, the ZIPs, the IFAs, and the ZIPs. So this illustrates what the characteristics are of dispatching with hyper-dispatch on and off. Moving to the next slide, CPU calculations. There are now two ways of looking at the utilization of an LPAR. There's the traditional NVS busy percent. You often see this in RMF reports. And that has been changed to take into account park time. And park time is when a load processor is actually put into a long wait. And if we subtract that park time from the existing calculation of online wait time, online time minus wait time divided by online time, what we'll see is the real ZOS view of the utilization of the LPAR. And then there's the traditional LPAR view of utilization, the physical utilization, and they haven't changed between hyper-dispatch off and hyper-dispatch on. Okay, moving to the next slide, performance considerations. This is slide 27. Typically, performance improvements, it's early days for hyper-dispatch, yeah, but there are performance improvements for mostly for large multi-book storage-intensive workloads in the 0 to 10% utilization range. Single-book workloads are going to benefit far less because they are already very localized in their use of level 2 caches. In terms of workload manager velocity goals, you need to look at adjusting those. I've got a whole slide on this, which I won't go through, but basically, because you have less processors, you are more likely to see work units, dispatchable units, waiting for a processor. It's not that the goal is not really being achieved or the work's not getting done in the same or even less time. It's just that instead of having even amounts of dispatch of logical processes in the LPAR, only a small subset is being used, but they again dispatch for a longer time slice. So each work unit is getting more of a time slice and getting the effects of the processor caching efficiency. But workload management goals need to be monitored, especially velocity goals. Again, WebSphere, transactional front ends may need their importance raised over CPU-intensive workloads. Bursts of activity in the front end might get swamped by the back end CPU activity, so you may want to raise the importance of the front end of WebSphere application. Next slide. I won't go through this. I just sort of explained it. But like I say, if we go to slide 29, here we see a Meg1XC. You can actually see the effect of short-running SRB work. SRBs, if you have something like BTAM or XCF address spaces, IRLM, TCP/IP, they run a lot of local SRBs. If they're not now, they should be put under hyperdispatch into the SysSTC or the system service classes because they will then run on the first available processor. It doesn't make sense. There's no advantage taking a hyperdispatch with this kind of work. And so this is just something that helps efficiency with these kinds of workloads. I show here how one can monitor with the address space CPU usage workspace, the SRB utilization of address spaces. So one can monitor that if you have homegrown address spaces that are dispatching a lot of local SRB work. They're not in SysSTC or system service classes. Put them in there. Next slide, low-weight LPARs. This I explained earlier. This is where a low utilization or a low-share LPAR, you're only going to get one medium, low-percentage processor allocated. Then hyper-dispatch with the appropriate maintenance will actually unpark a low processor so you can handle the workload and handle high and low-priority. I guess it's 12 o'clock. That's my local... fire station sirens going off. They test the siren every day. I'm sorry about that. I was hoping to get done before it went off. Okay, next the next slide, and we're getting towards the end here. We see the zip and zap crossover percentage implications. This is pretty technical, but the idea is that zaps are typically kept at less than 100% utilization to be most effective. And the problem that early customers of hyperdispatch saw is that not all the zaps were getting equal, getting normal dispatching a percentage. Hyperdispatch was focusing on one or just two of the zaps in, say, three or four zap pool. And there are some recommendations here that came from IBM Poughkeepsie, from performance, the performance gurus, and they basically are saying that to avoid seeing too much zap and zip on CP, one might want to use the parameters one here, zap AWMT. There's a recommended number. It says, how often do I want to look to see if a zap needs help from a standard processor? That's called crossover. And if you increase that number for zip and zap, they both have this control. It's called alternate weight management, then by increasing the number, there'll be less frequency in looking for help for the zaps, which will lower their utilization and lower the amount of crossover. But it's important to be aware of the fact that, you need to maybe increase the number of zaps under hyperdispatch because the focus of too much work on the zap or more than pre-hyperdispatch. Anyway, so we have the system CPU utilization panel in Meg1XC. This is where you would see the crossover, the system-wide or the LPAR-wide zap and zip crossover percentages, and you may be noticing an inordinate amount of that. You can get this value at the address space level, and so then one might want to go looking at the zap utilization across the complex and at these parameters here, the zap AWMT parameter. What follows is basically, and when I say here, we have day one supports for hyperdispatch coincident with the Z10 GA. And what follows are basically, if you want to just browse through them are the workspaces and screen spaces associated with our HyperDispatch support that were new or modified for the release. And we've actually seen all, you know, everything that you see on the following five or six slides is actually contained in the presentation. So if we go through the system CPUs, like this station workspace is the hook, is the link to HyperDispatch details in XE. The next slide shows the HyperDispatch details workspace, which contains exactly the same amount of information as that we've been seeing in the Meg 13070. Slide 35. There is a new menu entry for HyperDispatch. If you go to the Meg 13070 menu, you select the CPU option. That takes you to a new LPAR process and task utilization submenu. Select C for HyperDispatch from that menu. And if you go to the next slide, you'll see the HyperDispatch screen space, the HDSP command. There's full help behind that if you press PF1. And the sys command, the env mine of the sys command, if you're familiar with it, has been enhanced to indicate whether HyperDispatch mode is on, off, or in fact, HyperDispatch is not even available if you haven't got the right hardware and software and operating system combination. And the last slide I wanted to use is slide 38. And here we see just how you switch HyperDispatch on. It's in the IEA OPT member of System Palm Live. Simply HyperDispatch equals yes, equals no. You can dynamically switch HyperDispatch on or off when an LPAR is running. Through a Megamon, you could use the O command, OCMD command, which is an existing command, to set, to issue the COS set command with OPT equal to the suffix of the IA OPT member. And you can get the console output to see the success or failure of that through the CONS miner. So I have a summary. The summary on slide 39, HyperDispatch provides performance benefits through optimizing level 2 processor cache utilization. Turns out that, yeah, there's some level 1, level 1.5 benefits, but really it's level 2 processor cache utilization, that is the focus of HyperDispatch improvement. Performance is boosted through collaboration between Prism and ZOS. We've seen that. And degree of performance benefits varies, but it's a large multi-book. It's these large storage-intensive workloads. And what IBM has been seeing out in the field on the processors is that there are more and more of these storage-intensive workloads running out there. And the large-scale customers are going to be, you know, in the future, there'll be more processors, there'll be more books. HyperDispatch is going to only become more and more effective in those environments. That's why it was developed. Meg1 XE COS, it monitors the results of HyperDispatch actions, as we've seen, using new workspaces and existing workspaces and 3070 screen spaces in the Meg1 3070. If you're customer facing, then they probably already know. But it would be good to make them aware, or at least check that they're aware that there are several closed APARs that resolve some of them serious problems with HyperDispatch. That with full maintenance that's available today on, there are still one or two outstanding APARs, and that is if a complex is fully utilized, the entire complex physical resource is fully utilized. The parking of low processors, or I should say the lack of unparking of low utilization processors, has resulted in LPARs not consuming what should be their full share. That problem is being resolved, and by the end of January, an APAR is going to become available that includes a fix for that. I think I'm sorry I had to rush that. I squeezed my own time, but it's a lot of information. Hopefully it was useful. And there are backup slides behind this that explain some other dispatching mechanism-related topics. And like I say, you have the PowerPoints, so you know, please enjoy them or throw them away.
Thank you. Thank you, Lawrence. Any question on the phone? No, not at this time. All right. So you guys have my email address, and Lawrence is also available later on. And as you replay this session as it is recorded, feel free to drop us you know, an email with any question or any help you might want from, you know, from us, from the development team. And also keep coming with, you know, keep sending over, you know, requests for additional sessions. As you saw, I keep scheduling them like month of 2 month groups, and I already have part of the April April-May sessions scheduled, but keep sending requests, and I'll, you know, find the right speaker for you guys. So thank you very much for joining us today, and I'll talk to you all next week. Thank you very much, Lawrence.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.